Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for dropping along tonight to the Sydney Institute for our discussion on religious freedom, two views, and we asked two influential figures from Australian national politics. We're going to lead off with Tim Wilson, who's well known to you for his many television appearances and for other matters, the Liberal member for Goldstein and the former Human Rights Commissioner. And we're going to lead off with Tim. And then we go to Senator Kimberley Kitching, Deputy Manager of Opposition Business in the Senate and Shadow Assistant Minister for Government Accountability. That's it.
Need a lot of accountability.
And so, as you know, as you come to our, there's not a formal debate, we're just hearing two views on an issue, and we'll take questions and discussion. So we lead off with Tim, who makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute, having been here on a couple of times in the past. Thank you, Tim.
Well, thank you very much, Jared, for that very kind introduction, and for the opportunity to speak at the Sydney Institute again. And I do feel held very much accountable this evening by Senator Kitching, and I want to welcome you, of course, as well as everybody else present. And I'd actually like to begin by paying respect to the Aboriginal spirituality, which was the youngest median age of adherence of spiritualities on the census at 28 years of age, while also acknowledging the enduring connection to the land on which we meet, even if we are 40 stories up. The Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and thank Anne Gerard and, of course, Nancy Henderson for hosting this important discussion on religious freedom. And I guess we have to start by asking ourselves the question, or the topic begs the question, which is, what is the problem that we're actually trying to solve when we're discussing freedom of religion or religious freedom? The human right of freedom of religion is sacrosanct, of course, in our liberal democracy. And apart from property rights, it is the only human right protected by our constitution. The importance of religious freedom dates back thousands of years, and in the Anglo tradition, people often forget that the principle of the separation of church and state, which goes to the heart in many ways of freedom of religion, is not just to ensure that the church does not unnecessarily interfere with the state, but actually more critically, it's part of a long tradition of making sure that we guarantee the independence of the church. Now, of course, the church is meant in the context, obviously, of the UK at the time of the Catholic Church, but what we now know as the Catholic Church, but includes a wide variety of understandings of the importance and independence of institutions separate from the state. Any discussion on freedom of religion or religious freedom understandably invokes strong views and goes to the heart of people's sense of security and individuality in society. And I say that because it cuts across both sides. Everybody has a sense of security that touches in part on freedom of religion. People use the terms freedom of religion and religious freedom interchangeably, but they are quite different concepts. Freedom of religion is the right of a person to exercise their conscience to hold a religious faith or spiritual belief or not to do so. Religious freedom is the freedom to manifest that conscience in word and deed. It's limited by the need to respect the rights and the freedoms of others. And so when we get together to talk about religious freedom, it's pretty easy to confuse and people to get into a definitional war, but it's critical to actually understand and make sure we're all having the same conversation. I'll return to that later. Of course, freedom of religion is unlimited because it has no material impact on others. It's simply about people's freedom to be able to think what they wish and to adhere to their conscience within themselves. The latter is always limited, religious freedom, because it ultimately can license certain behaviours one way or the other by law. You should be able, of course, to manifest your faith through prayer, collective worship, and evangelise, so long as you don't do harm to others. And that, of course, is a non-negotiable test of a society's commitment to liberalism. Religious freedom, though, doesn't license certain types of practices just because you believe it or because you believe that your spiritual leader, God or faith leader, justifies it, whether it's from public stoning or enacting a holy war against non-believers or people of other faith. Now, of course, both of those ends are the extremes. And, of course, that isn't the spectrum in which there is mainstream dispute. When you look at what actually happens in a mainstream society like Australia today, the tensions exist when the private essentially becomes the public, and the extent to which you can use your freedom of religion and manifest it through some form of religious freedom to interact with others. And that sits culture by culture, society by society. And of course, even the type of society we have is a point of contest for many people. Depending on who you speak to, you'll hear that we're a secular country, or that we have a secular government, or that we have a secular society. And of course, secularism means different things depending on the society. In France, it means faith is left at the chapel door, or that you can't even make modest expressions of your public faith, including wearing certain types of ornaments or, of course, head garments. In the United States, it means public faith but secular government. At the 1897 Constitutional Convention, Australia's first Prime Minister, though not yet, argued, "The whole mode of government, the whole province of the state, is secular. The whole duty is to render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's. That is the line of division maintained in every state in which there is not a predominant church government which dictates to all civil institutions. The best plan, which is so likely to create dissension foreign to the objects of any church or any Christian community, is that secular expressions be left to secular matters, while prayer should be left to its proper place." And that in itself, that quote from Edmund Barton, highlights almost the, I won't say confusion, but I will say tension that always sits at the heart of freedom of religion and religious freedom in Australia. Because Barton's quote needs to be put into context. At the Federation census, 96% of Australians identified as some form of Christian, dominated by the Church of England or Roman Catholics, at 41% and 24% of the population respectively. Therefore, laws and norms were inherited from England and underpinned by what we now call Judeo-Christian values. And of course, that is even referenced directly in Barton's quote. Since then, Australia has gone on a journey from a Christian to a multi-faith, and some people would now argue, at least a post-faith tradition that is emerging within a secular state and a society. And depending on your views, will very much inform your attitude towards freedom of religion and religious freedom. The secularism has taken different forms throughout our history and has twinned with pluralism is important. And presently, it's secular laws coupled with respecting diversity and choice through institutions funded to provide public service as well as accommodation of faith in the public square and in the workplace. And what's surprising is that many people seem to have concerns about religious freedom more recently, since recent debates about the legalisation of marriage for same-sex couples, a debate, of course, which I'm very familiar. And that's a misdiagnosis, because the trajectory around the challenges of religious freedom were already set. At the last census, the largest group was those who identified with no religion, at 30.1%, up from 22.3% from the 2011 census. Catholic was 22.6, down from 25.3, and Anglicans were 13.3, down from 17.1. Concurrently, Islam has grown from 2.2 to 2.6, Hinduism 1.3 to 1.9, and Sikhism from 0.3 to 0.5%. Generationally, the median age of Christians is 44 years old, Islam 27, and no religion at 31, and Sikhism at 29, which of course says that for the predominant religions of the past, they have an older adherence amongst an older population in comparison to their children or grandchildren, which in some parts, even if off a small base, belongs to other faiths. It might say that these demographic challenges do not undermine the moral case for the freedom of religion. They don't, because liberal thinkers since John Stuart Mill have written and spoken of the need to protect minorities from tyrannical majorities. And so those challenges remain. But as society becomes more multicultural, it also becomes more multi-faith. And as society becomes more multi-faith, the state needs to proactively decouple itself from religious traditions and become more humanist and secular to accommodate that diversity. It's a direct consequence of having a more multicultural society. And of course, that assumes that that's only about faith. There are, of course, other sections of the community that may have traditionally been marginalised or isolated that are being brought into the mainstream community as well. But that, of course, puts more pressure on the state to become more humanist and more secular. The overarching narrative within contemporary discussion appears to be that people want to be left alone, to practice their faith without any sense of interference. And I doubt few would contest that. People of faith want to be free to associate with those of like faith and practice. But that is almost impossible when activities concurrently involve outreach for education, charity or commerce. At some point you come into interaction with others. And as the Ruddock Review found, no one during the review challenged the right to hold or not to hold a religious belief. Few took issue with the right of religious institutions to operate freely within certain parameters. For example, to discriminate in appointing clergy, to control the use of their places of worship, and for religious ministers to be able to choose not to solemnise same-sex marriages. What goes behind the chapel door basically remains behind the chapel door, so long as it doesn't breach any laws. But it is what goes on beyond the chapel door that matters, with the report identifying the, quote, a common characteristic of many of the representations made to the panel was apprehension, even fear. People of faith were apprehensive that religious freedom may come under threat in Australia. The panel heard many examples of changes to legislation or judicial decisions from overseas that underpinned this apprehension. Now, religious freedom for people of faith is actually like anyone else's freedom. Religious freedom no more ends at the chapel door as sexual orientation ends at the bedroom door. These characteristics inform all aspects of our life. But what is clear is that increasingly religiously devout Australians seem to feel that if they outwardly manifest their faith, they'll be denied employment, face social exclusion, or fall foul of the law. Now, the reality is that actually all sounds very familiar to some sections of the community. It seems that religiously devout Australians, or at least some do, feel like they almost need to act as, and pardon the expression, Christians in the closet. Recent legal cases seem to validate some of these concerns for people. For instance, the Christian Youth Camps versus Cowbell Community Health Centre's case included the CYC breaching Victoria's Equal Opportunity Act for denying use of their facilities to a group that tolerated homosexuality. Of course, there's the famous Julian Porteous case breaching Section 17, or alleging to breach Section 17 of the Tasmanian Anti-Discrimination Act for offending, insulting and ridiculing people based on their gender and sexual orientation by propagating the idea that marriage is a union between a man and a woman. The Baptist Care case being pursued through the Queensland Industrial Relations Commission for advocating, again, to people to vote against marriage for same-sex couples, though it is not just solely about this issue. And, of course, the most famous one of recent times, which is around Israel Folau having his contract terminated with Rugby Australia for claiming that just about anybody who wants to have some fun is going to hell. And, of course, there's the even more recent example, which is his cousin Josiah Folau being fired from a Catholic school for claiming that the church is, quote, the synagogue of Satan.
Oh, it is.
Regardless of your view on that particular matter, it doesn't change the fact that people are entitled to their view. How you approach religious freedom largely depends, as I said earlier, on your perspective. A liberal is rightly concerned with the freedom of religion as part of a package of the freedoms to manifestation for everyone. The question we need to answer is, why is the manifestation of religious freedom gaining any primacy simply because it is linked to conscience, and whether that can be separated from others who want to manifest their freedom, and how? A liberal understands that all people are equal and no one has more rights fundamentally than others. If you can freely associate with someone, should the motivation really be relevant? Should Greenpeace be compelled to hire workers who wail in their spare time? Acknowledging that's a pretty unlikely scenario, but you never know. Should liberals be forced to hire people who think the true Marxism has never properly been tried, otherwise it would have succeeded? Or that there can't be women's only gyms, male only gay nightclubs, or Indigenous only cooperatives? If we have chosen to draw a distinction between conscience and commerce, then faith shouldn't give you bonus rights above the rights of others. In contemporary Australia, successfully defending religious freedom depends on consistency for everybody's freedom. So long as we believe in the principle of non-discrimination, and that's in itself a highly contested proposition, is one that's basically invented by the United Nations and other agencies and governments in the mid-20th century, but assuming we do, it should accommodate what is necessary for people to be able to live out their lives without doing harm to others. And presently, that broadly exists in the way laws operate, except because of the traditions and the history we have applied around religious institutions where, for the most part, there's been general exemptions that have been all-encompassing, and those are the ones that come under threat. And let's not pretend that they aren't used. They are, though mostly discreetly, and I acknowledge that, and most of it by mutual agreement. But then there are occasionally cases that do rise to the surface, where, for instance, the principal Foundation Christian College in Mandurah, Western Australia, chose to tell a 7-year-old girl that had they known about the circumstances of her father's relationship, she would have been denied education at that institution. In a study into the use of exemptions under anti-discrimination law by Professor Caroline Evans from the University of Melbourne, she found that, among others, an unmarried pregnant teenager could have been excluded from Islamic schools. Since the topic of religious freedom has arisen in public discourse, I've got to say that the initial reaction I've received from many Australians in suburbia has not been overly sympathetic, which is an interesting intersection between the philosophical to the practical. I've had people say to me, does that mean priests that don't have to report pedophilia, which they find within the confessional? To bring back haunting memories for some people, for instance, of single mothers who felt excluded by various religious leaders in the 70s and the 80s. And, of course, in the extreme cases, people ask whether this means we're going to tolerate things like female genital mutilation. Some being cultural, obviously, and some being legal. Apart from the devout concern for their own security, the instinctive response from many Australians I've found has been cautious at best, which leaves us to where we face as a government. And I'm speaking, I just need to clarify, as a member of Parliament, not on behalf of the government. A Religious Discrimination Act, which is designed to fill the gap between the other race, sex, age and disability discrimination acts, making unlawful for people mistreat someone simply because of their faith or the lack thereof. I suspect most Australians will have no issue with such a proposal so long as it remains a religious anti-discrimination act as part of the orthodox approach towards anti-discrimination law. Where tensions could arise if it becomes and shifts from being a discussion around the Religious Anti-Discrimination Act to focusing on religious freedom designed to shift the discussion from protecting people's faith for unjust discrimination towards alternatives. Philosophically, that creates challenges as a liberal. Liberals don't believe in legislating permission. Freedom is the default, and justification is made about why laws should encroach upon that freedom, not that it should prescribe what people can and cannot do. A Religious Freedom Act would likely give rise to inconsistencies where people of faith have more freedom than others, not including for non-religious Australians. And this could work to significantly undermine perceptions of cohesion and unity. When the idea of the Ruddock Review was first floated, many were warned that if the objective was to enlarge religious freedom, it was probably not a wise approach. Instead, it was more likely to inform Australians about the wide-ranging freedoms that religious institutions already enjoy, and which have flown largely under the radar because of historical reasons. And let's be frank, the leaking of the report before its official release showed that this was correct. Attempting to specifically legislate further for freedom not enjoyed by the rest of the community could raise serious eyebrows within the community. Strategically, may also be the best pathway for success. While there is a section of the community that is hostile to faith, in my experience, most Australians' attitudes reflect the observations of the Prime Minister, where he wrote at the start of this year in an opinion article in the Daily Telegraph, quote, "As for religion, it's our own personal business. What you believe is up to you, and no one should give you a hard time about it. Don't just tell us what to believe or use your religion as an excuse not to obey the laws," end quote. And the foundation of that perspective is an Australia built on mutual respect, that the law should respect citizens, but mutual respect lives more in our culture than in laws. If you want our freedom respected, you need to respect the freedom of others to live their lives too. And that hasn't always been reciprocated in these debates in the past. And where it hasn't, understandably, there's a pretty low degree of trust from some sections of the community, which is always a difficult place to start a conversation if you want it to be constructive. For those who know what it means to be part of a minority faces a big choice, and is whether to show the grace they felt denied by fighting for the rights and freedoms of everybody. And that's the basis in which I and any Liberal should proceed in this discussion. Thank you.
Many thanks, Tim Wilson. Senator Kitching.
I'd like to thank Jared and Nancy Henderson as well, and the staff of the Sydney Institute, and you, ladies and gentlemen, for making the time this evening to come here to be engaged, I think, in what is a very interesting topic and still has great relevance today. I too would like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation as the custodians of the land on which we meet and pay my respects to their elders, past, present and emerging. Like Tim, I thought about the welcome to country and I thought about the spirituality of Indigenous Australians, their connection to the land and the complexity of the dream time. Of course, Indigenous Australians are not alone in having developed an ancient belief system. Humankind has had belief systems from early times, whether they be idolatry or bear worship in the Northern Hemisphere, through to the ancient Vedic texts of Hinduism, through to the current day when, as I speak and as we gather here this evening, the Hajj journey to Mecca is being undertaken by pilgrims, about to make Mecca one of the most populated places on earth. And what I would posit is that through the millennia, faith or having a system of belief is an inherent part of being human. The very part of us today that looks up to the welkin, as we have done since we could raise our heads and look up and wonder at the stars and think of stories of the stars or of God above, and it connects us through the ages and to each other. So how has this very humanness manifested itself in our society? And by our society, I mean a Western liberal democracy, which is pluralist and which is tolerant and which is secular. So I'm going to offer some threshold definitional contexts. When I say secular, I do not mean secularist. I mean not bound to a religion or an ideology. When I say I do not mean secularist, I take secularism as a belief system that rejects religion. I do not accept that my society should be secularist. I also do not mean a secular integralist society, so a society where there is a fully integrated social and political order and sometimes additionally national or ethnic unity. As an historical example, in the 19th century there was a Catholic integralist movement in Western Europe which held that there are two powers that rule humanity, a temporal power represented by the state and a spiritual power represented by the Catholic Church. Integralists believe that since man's temporal end is subordinated to his eternal end, the temporal power, that is the state, must be subordinated to the spiritual power, that is the church. The world in all its aspects is to take shape only under the direct or indirect action of the church. This is obviously an anti-pluralist movement. Fortunately, Australia rejected anti-pluralism very early on. At first, the Church of England was the established religion in the colony of New South Wales. And during the early years of transportation, all convicts were required to attend Anglican services on Sundays. This included Irish Catholics as well as Jews. Similarly, education in the new settlement was Anglican Church controlled until the 1840s. Although I note that the first Catholic school was established in Parramatta in 1820. And at this point, I hope I don't embarrass her, but I'm going to acknowledge former Senator Jacinta Collins, now the Executive Director of the National Catholic Education Commission, who in fact alerted me to this fact several months ago and the fact that there would be the celebration of 200 years of Catholic education in Australia next year. The Church of England lost its legal privileges in the colony of New South Wales following the Church Act of 1836. Drafted by the Catholic Attorney General, John Plunkett, the Act established legal equality for Anglicans, Catholics and Presbyterians, and this was later extended to Methodists. This piece of history does remind me of the 60s comedian Dick Emery's joke that there are two things I abhor, religious intolerance and Methodists.
It wasn't a joke.
But Australia, by welcoming people from all around the world, is a pluralist society. What we have seen, however, in recent years is a discussion in Western liberal democracies, and the reason those discussions occur in those societies is because they are tolerant, in which there is a view in some quarters that an agnostic or atheist belief should be privileged because it is more rational. That is, they desire that our society should be secularist, that is, a society that rejects religion. What I would say, and what I was struck by, particularly during the religious freedom inquiry undertaken by the Senate Legal and Constitutional Committee, was the lack of depth of understanding of mainstream religious doctrine and practice. I sometimes wonder whether this is a lack of intellectual curiosity among secularists. Indeed, I have found that some most hostile to the protection of religious freedom are the most lacking in intellectual curiosity. And at this point, I would quote Corinthians. When I was a child, I spake as a child, I understood as a child, and I thought like a child. But when I became an adult, I put away childish things. There is another angle of this discussion, formed from the suspicion of some, and indeed I often reflect on this on Sunday mornings when I see Jared is sharing a couch on television with her fellow commentator, that see the power of the Christian church historically as occupying a position of privilege as an integral part of the state. I do not want this either. And I think as politicians we are very aware, because of the wide variety of events we attend, whether it be a particular church or a particular belief such as atheism, none of those things should be privileged in our society. A further reflection on secular integralism is that I am reminded that in the last century and in this one, that in authoritarian and autocratic regimes, that political party symbols have been placed behind altars of worship. Indeed, it is happening in some parts of the world today. I would also add that it is nearly impossible to have a totally secularist society, or indeed a secular integralist society today, as much as some might wish it. As Felipe Fernandez Armesto wrote in his Out of Our Minds, What We Think and How We Came to Think It, he says, God matters. If you believe in him, he is the most important thing in or beyond the cosmos. If you don't, he matters because the way belief in him influences those who do. Jonathan Haidt writes in his influential book, The Righteous Mind, why good people are divided by politics and religion. Religions are moral exoskeletons. Societies that forego the exoskeleton of religion should reflect carefully on what will happen to them over several generations. For example, one might know the commandment, thou shalt not kill, and that commandment can be in many forms and in many words, in many languages, but the commandment rests and is immediately understood because it is a basic rule of living in a society. Very briefly, I am going to turn to the two committees of inquiry in the 45th Parliament, namely the Senate Select Committee into Amendments to the Marriage Act, the same-sex marriage inquiry, and the Senate Standing Committee on Legal and Constitutional Affairs inquiry into religious freedom. The reason I raise these, hopefully briefly, is that these committees raised matters that are very complex and very difficult to address. I was a member of both of these committees for those inquiries. The first committee, the inquiry into same-sex marriage, had, I think, it's fair to say, the full spectrum of views on it. And I would say that that committee was extremely fortunate to have Senator David Fawcett, a Liberal senator from South Australia, as the chair. He is infinitely patient and even-handed. Despite the range of views on that committee, the committee members were incredibly respectful of each other and of each other's views. And I'd like you to think about this whenever you see a particularly fractious question time, and to know that it isn't always like that. It was a privilege to be on that committee and to come to learn each other's views and how my colleagues had arrived at deeply held convictions. But this committee also exposed the question, what are we trying to fix? Although this committee was looking at amendments to the Marriage Act, it was impossible to undertake that task without also examining philosophical and theological questions. For example, what is a belief system? One committee member had friends who are animists, and animism is a belief system. Should we be hearing evidence from animists? Senator James Patterson, another committee member, Liberal Senator from Victoria, and I have his permission to quote him, said at one point, I'm not particularly religious, but I do live my life by a set of principles, and that should be respected as well as religious belief. And of course, that respect must be consistent across society. And what also became apparent was that there were differing views on, even without looking at anything beyond the Abrahamic faiths, there were differences, there were different committee members had different views on whether one of those would take precedence over others. So that consistency, I think, is important. And perhaps not in the case of like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who, of course, in defence of his book Emile, was subject to both condemnation by Calvinist Geneva and Catholic Paris. So I don't mean quite like that. I mean consistency in respect. So again, one must ask, not only what are we trying to fix, but also what are we trying to protect? This committee could have met and met and met. But in the end, the government decided to have an expert panel look at religious freedom. This is more colloquially known as the Ruddock Review into Religious Freedom. This report of the expert panel was severely delayed in being released by the government, and as Tim has said, all of the recommendations were leaked before it was formally released. In the meantime, a reference for an inquiry into religious freedom by the Senate Standing Committee for Legal and Constitutional Affairs was accepted. And that looked at the recommendation around from the Ruddock report around the Sex Discrimination Act exemptions, particularly around students, and because it created a great deal of discussion. During the rather febrile Wentworth by-election, how long ago that seems, Mr Morrison joined with the Labor Party to promise discrimination law amendments to make clear no student at a faith-based school should be expelled by removing the exemption which relates to the ability of faith-based schools to discriminate against students based on their sexual orientation, their gender identity, marital or relationship status, or pregnancy. Mr Morrison stated at the time that our government does not support expulsion of students from religious non-state schools on the basis of their sexuality. Again, I would draw your attention to the balancing of rights. There are the rights of the student, the rights of the parents, the rights of the faith-based school. Some parents have argued that where they send their children is an extension of their pedagogical rights to raise their children. And I can tell you in the northwest of Melbourne, there are some in religious communities, for example the Sikh community, who are sending their children to Catholic schools. I give you all of the exemptions contained, particularly in Section 38 of the Sex Discrimination Act, because I do not think it is actually helpful to have a dialectic exist between particular groups of rights, that is, the LGBTIQ rights versus the rights of those of faith. It is actually not helpful to have that as the log at those rights being at loggerheads. But I think we do have to know and acknowledge that we are living in a society where there is always a contest of rights. Now, going to the present day, members of the government are at an advantage here. Certainly the Attorney General, Mr. Porter, has been conducting sessions with backbenchers to discuss the Religious Freedom Bill, which I think is in some sort of draft form, but I would encourage you to ask Tim questions. The Leader of the Opposition, Mr. Anthony Albanese, has made it clear that he is prepared to work cooperatively on issues which should not be the subject of partisan politics, and that includes that issue, that is religious freedom. It is unclear as yet whether the bill that the Attorney General is proposing covers the exemptions in the Sex Discrimination Act or not, or it may be responsive to the expert panel's central conclusion that there is an opportunity to better protect, promote, and balance the right to freedom of religion. We will have to wait to see what grounds the bill covers. Of course, what it may not contradict is the protection in Section 116 of the Constitution. Where is the Labor Party in this? Chris Bowen has said that the failure to address the concerns of religious Australians is an existential problem for the Labor Party. He says, "I mean, in most religions, as you say, preach love and respect and tolerance and understanding and justice. We might use different words, but it's what we're about as well. But we've lost the connection with people of faith and we must get it back. I don't mean to be melodramatic. I regard it as an existential crisis." There will always be a contest of ideas about where we came from and where we are going. This has no end, and no laws are able to absolutely define what makes us most human. If a statute for religious freedom is able to enhance a pluralist secular society and optimise opportunity for everybody, then I am all in favour of it. This should not pander to the extremes or to the integralists on either end. The simple truth is that shared Australian values, including respect for people of faith, should be a unifying shield against those who preach division or hatred within, or threaten hostility and instability from beyond our shores. In a complex and rapidly changing world, we ought to remain steadfast and strong about what we value and are fighting every day to defend. Religious freedom, including the right not to believe, is just as important as all other Australian freedoms and traditions. It is well worth defending. Thank you.
Just stay there for a minute. So many thanks to both our speakers for both thoughtful presentations. Now, we'll come to questions and discussion. So, Tim, if you get up, after I ask the question, I'll move there. Kimberly, you can come here. But I'll ask, no, you stay there first. I'll ask it first. Now, can I just ask you both to state, we've got to be brief because a lot of people here, we've got to finish by the top of the hour. 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, the Sydney Institute would not have put this function on. It wasn't an issue. So how come this, how do you explain the fact, in your view, that this issue became such a prominent matter of debate in the Australian community?
I think it occurred because, it was brought to the forefront of people's consciousness by the same-sex marriage debate, I think. But I also wonder, and I spend some time thinking about, I don't really love this term, but I'm just going to use it for to be expeditious, and that is the culture wars. And I think that also has become more prevalent. I think a discussion around that has become more prevalent, but I think in the Parliament it's because of the same-sex marriage debate.
Jim? I completely disagree with Kimberly. It's the legacy of decisions that were made before I was even born around changing social and cultural norms about relationships, sexuality, child rearing, and they're followed through to points of maturity that now exist within society where we have a much greater diversity. It's also come as a consequence of the declining stature of particularly traditional religious institutions who have been exposed for hypocrisy, particularly around things like child sex abuse and everything else, and so that has diminished their authority within society, amongst the community as well as amongst those in position of power and authority. It's also come as a consequence of bad law. I mean, if you look at particularly Section 17 of the Tasmanian Anti-Discrimination Act, which was obviously the law that at least a complaint was brought against somebody like Julian Porteous, such a law invites complaints and encourages people to use legislation as a vehicle or a mechanism to seek out retribution, of which you then add a contemporary debate, which is the fulfilment of a lot of those discussions around changing attitudes and norms towards social and relationship status, and it's all culminated in one discussion.
Okay, so Tim, stay there. Okay, so question down here.
Pretty young, Tim and Kim. Should large organisations like public companies or unions or other organisations like that with diverse membership and shareholders, should they be curtailed in any way in commenting on religious matters?
So,
I think there is no harm in having more people engaged in any kind of debate. So I'll give you an example. When I was on the Melbourne City Council, so I always feel I'm up a few levels of purgatory for doing that, but when I was there, I realised that there was a Greens councillor on there. We didn't agree on a lot, but I was very appreciative of the fact that he was engaged. So I don't actually mind that people have lots of different views, but I do mind, I'll tell you what I do mind, is when you go to stand on a polling place and people say to you, I can't believe I've got to vote again. Oh, I voted only a few months ago. I would much rather people be engaged in a conversation about what kind of society we want than not.
Tim? The short answer is I don't see why we would want to constrain them from doing so. It's just like being in a court. They have no standing. Now, of course, individuals might, within those traditions of those organisations, might, because of their private faith, but I don't know why anyone of a faith, why a faith tradition would pay much attention to what a corporate or a union or any other organisation really thought.
Person here.
Welcome to the finest city in Australia, by the way.
Okay, can we get on with it?
Coming to Wentworth, Kimberley, in case you're wondering. Ronald Ryan, the last man hanged in Australia, said Roman Catholicism was a hard religion to live in, but was certainly a good one to die in. But just following on from that, what concerned me about the same-sex debate was the way Margaret Court was treated. Regardless of the views, I'm not talking about the issue, but I'm talking about the abuse he copped and the rubbish he had to put up with.
Okay. Do you want to respond about Margaret Court?
Sure. Firstly, it's a pleasure to be in the city of Sydney and to have two Victorians come and talk to you about intellectual matter. The short answer, Leon, is I agree with you. I said publicly at the time I thought the way she was treated was disgraceful, and I think the campaign to remove her name from the tennis centre is extremely unwise and would only backfire and basically makes her into a martyr. I said it's pointless. I mean, everybody has blemishes within the history, and I do believe she has some views which I definitely don't ascribe to, but she's entitled to them in a free society.
Emily?
Well, look, I mean, this debate, I think, has continued with Israel Folau, and I don't agree with what he said. That, I mean, I think in some ways he misconceived, not only was it misquoting, but it was misconceives Christianity. He doesn't, God gets to be judge, not Israel Folau. And I don't agree with what he said, but, you know, I mean, he has a right to his views.
Lindy.
If there is to be legislation, can it be anything more than motherhood statements? And if it is motherhood statements, do we just handball the problem, like all our other problems, to the judges, or worse still, to the Human Rights Commission?
You can defend the Human Rights Commission.
To be fair, the Human Rights Commission, I mean, their job is to implement the laws. And so the law is in question. Like, my big beef with Section 18 of the Racial Discrimination Act, like Section 17, is the law as much as it is about how it might practice in the commission. So, I mean, my view is that with most things around religious freedom, they're actually not best dealt with through law. They're dealt with by reasoned people in a large space of civil society. And that the law's purpose should only really be to come in at a point where there's a clear delineation line. Otherwise, it should be through reasoned adult and conversation. And Kimberley respectfully made the error, which is what the government has said is that it's going to introduce an anti-discrimination law to sit as part of the full comprehensive suite of anti-discrimination laws. A religious freedom law will be completely different and risks going down the pathway of things like a Bill of Rights. Well, that's the sort of conversation, because you can't just legislate for some people's rights and not others. And as somebody who opposes a Bill of Rights or a Charter of Rights, I think that's one of the reasons why we won't go down that path.
Emily?
I think there is real danger in... I'm going to give you a concrete example. Section 38 of the Sex Discrimination Act, which deals with... faith-based schools, for example, so educators, so contractors, teachers, students in the section, various subsections. What occurs to me that if we were to remove some of those exemptions and not have something else in place, which has certainly been alluded to, in fact, by the current Prime Minister, let's say you go for a job interview and you go to a faith-based school and they say, oh, look, we don't really like the look of that person. I think the unintended consequence of the amendments to that legislation, without having something else in place, will mean you will have covert discrimination. And in fact, you would be legislating in a way that people would not be obeying the law. So I actually think legislation done with that result is kind of, you know, is not good legislation, obviously. So I actually think that covert discrimination is terrible, that you would never find out really why you didn't get a job in that instance, I think is dreadful. So I actually think you do need, if you believe that faith-based schools should be able to teach their religion, to teach their doctrine, etc., then you must have some way of actually deciding who is going to teach it. Now, there was a discussion in the Religious Freedoms Inquiry about, you know, only limiting. So some committee members believed that only teachers teaching religious in education should be have any religious faith. The rest of the curriculum would be set by presumably the state. But I don't think that works either, because as we know, there are many ways to teach To Kill a Mockingbird, for example, or whatever it might be. So I understand what Tim's saying, and I think that though that we are dealing with, we are going to try, if it's motherhood, I think we could have a motherhood thing, but really we're there already. We've got enough case law around that. But I think if we're delving into something else, we better be very careful about balancing what we're going to do. Because I think also it would set up... I was very disturbed at some of the groups suggesting that they would run test cases with teachers going to courts, because I actually think that they're sacrificing those teachers to make the case law, and that also is terrible.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think Tim agreed with our proposition.
I did agree with
that. To take up Mr. Wilson's point, if the criterion is going to be legislation based on a principle of anything which does not cause harm to others being a parameter, is that not going to raise this issue about whether offending people is causing them harm, and bring back that kind of debate?
So, I mean, I don't agree with the basic proposition that offending somebody should be the test in law, but I don't think that is so. Under federal law, apart from the Racial Discrimination Act, there's no equivalent for the space of religion. Now, I would be shocked and amazed if we went down that path. I'm certainly not aware of any such proposals, because that would in and of itself lead us into a space around blasphemy laws, which I would have thought would have been comprehensively rejected by the Parliament, and also expose the deep hypocrisy at the heart of Labor's position on the Racial Discrimination Act as well.
I want to talk... Well, I think that... I mean, we should be able to have robust discussion, and I think, you know, I'm sure that not everyone in this room agrees with everyone else, but if we can do it in a way that allows for different points of view, then I think we're pretty much there. I mean, that's what our society is about.
Good. Jacinta?
Thank you, Jared. Kimberly, you made reference to pretty much Australia's unique environment in delivering school education, where one third of Australian students attend faith-based schools. And I'd like to give you the opportunity to respond, and please, Jim, if I'm reflecting it inaccurately, jump in, to the comment that the more faith-based a society is, the more humanist or the more secular society should become. Because I think that's another area of difference between the two of you that hadn't been highlighted in the discussion before now.
Can I just make a point of... I didn't say about society, I said about government.
Can you come up to the...
Sorry.
And just, could you back around that? Because...
Okay. So the question was asked... Sorry, I'm not meaning to interrupt, but my argument was the more diverse a society becomes, the more secular and humanist government ultimately becomes. Not society. And there's an important distinction, because one of the things we've done is, as a society, as a government, and continue to do, is to turn around and say there is diversity within society, and at least in Australia, we respect that diversity by allowing religious institutions to provide services, but that the government ultimately has to make choices about the values that underpin it, and it naturally becomes more secular and humanist, just to clarify, not society.
Kimberly.
Firstly, I want to say that I want to say firstly that this is really not a Dorothy Dixer. I think that people might say that I feel that Judeo-Christian tenets underpin our society, and
correct,
thank God for that. So, I actually think that it doesn't... People claim that they're all sorts of things, and they're agnostic and atheist and whatever else they are. but in fact really what they are coming back to is the principles that have been established over millennia. So I don't think that, you know, I think even government, so even if it wasn't society, but even if it's just government, I think government is still bound by those principles. So I think of, you know, St. Augustine, for example. Those, I mean, they inform every day our way of legislating.
I just want to build on that point, because I don't think there's any real disagreement between us on this, because underpinning our approach to even secularism and humanism are a lot of those principles, and liberalism by its nature is intrinsically intertwined in its development with the values that underpin much of Christian teaching. It's just the extent to which you can use that then to impose onto others or oblige others around their adherence, because pluralism by its nature is directly connected to liberalism.
I don't think you've got the...
No, I don't agree. Okay, well, I do.
You want to briefly respond? You don't have to.
Well, you know, I'm very chatty. I don't think liberalism has, either in its classical or revisionist forms, has a sort of, you know, has a hold on pluralism. I think that, that is a much greater, by its very nature, pluralism appeals to many parts.
I never said it was a hold. I just said it's a consistent part of the theme. To say it's a hold would be say it's exclusive, but I'm not saying that.
There's a question here.
Thank you.
We're getting close to the end now, so... Okay.
It sort of follows on from the gentleman's question over there about... You mentioned it's okay for Israel Folau to have his opinion.
I think what he said is disgusting.
Yeah.
But...
In the style of Voltaire, but you'll defend his right to...
Well, that wasn't actually Voltaire. That's always been a misattribution. Yeah. But yes, I take the point.
But my question is, when does that comment or that opinion become regarded as hate speech, where we would want to have something in place to discourage it?
Well, we do. We have racial vilification. We have racial vilification acts. So I'm, you know, very conscious, obviously, that one of the reasons that many groups didn't want to weaken 18C, for example, the Jewish community, was because they wanted to have something in there that protected them from anti-Semitic statements. So I think we do have legislation, but I think the reason it is so important to have people engaged in this kind of topic and thinking about what they will and will not tolerate is because actually, in the end, the mass will... People will say that is not acceptable, what you are saying and what you are doing. So my view, when I say a tolerant society, I actually think tolerant societies should not necessarily tolerate the intolerant.
Do you want to add to that too?
I think the Israel Folau case is a terrible example of any trying to have any reasoned or rational discussion, because there are so many different areas of sections of law that intersect with each other, between the extent to which he was operating in the workplace versus not being in the workplace, because his account was endorsed by Rugby Australia and advertised by it, versus one that was a private account which was perhaps only advertised to some of his friends, etc., etc. But I think the test, and I've been on the record on this consistently, is when somebody engages in conduct that amounts to harassment of people, simply expressing an unpopular view, isn't within itself a justification to say that somebody should be limited by what they have to say.
We may have time for two more, but we've got one here and then one there if we get time. Yep.
I suppose it touches on things that have just been discussed, but a fundamental plank of democracy is freedom of speech.
Mm.
And we're seeing through political correctness, no platforming, and now the issue of the freedom of people to put on Facebook what they believe in, and then the consequence being that they lose their job if they do that. Isn't democracy being shut down now in this country?
A couple of quick responses, then we go there. Yep. The question is democracy being gradually shut down in the country because of restrictions?
Well, there are a couple of concerns around particularly the power of corporations and how they use their social media policies in that space, yes. But you know, you've got now got the conflicting examples. You've got Israel Folau being fired by Rugby Australia for going out and saying anyone's had fun is going to hell. And then you've got Josiah Folau going out and saying something against the church and what he believes in. And then everybody goes quiet and says that's acceptable. So it really goes back to the extent to which we say religion holds a preeminent place above the rights and freedoms of others, and really the extent to which we then turn around and say values can inform an organisation, its purpose, and the extent to which they can bind others to that. And that's the conflict that's coming out and about, and particularly about whether we accept more, how would you put it, to the extent to which you find non-faith-based value systems to underpin how organisations can operate.
Kimberly?
I find it very disturbing that people can't express their view, and I just think we've seen an election where people have, I really don't want to use this term, but the quiet Australians have had a view, and I mean I do speak with a variety of the crossbench in the Senate, and you know, some of them have had great electoral success. It's not just about electoral success, but I think it's reflected in people's disquiet around not being able to express themselves. And I think I think about it every day.
On that, we agree.
Just a quick one, but taking you back to the humanist, secular. And take you back to representatives of the Australian people. Humanism, as you go about, you know, the community, it's not as clearly defined. What is a humanist? You know, most people will be on the theism. They'll say, I don't believe in God. But ask them to unpack, and there's a lot of translation errors. So you're both interesting, you know, you're both touching interesting points. But that is a big problem around these debates. So do you agree or not, and share your views, please?
So let's just make this the final comment from both of you. Let's start off with let's start off with Tim.
Okay. The whole space is infected with definitional debates and how they're interpreted depending on people's life experiences, because that's ultimately what we're discussing. People's rights to raise their children consistent with their culture and their values and their religious teachings, how that then goes and informs people and how they live their lives overall, and then how they apply that within a society. And the tension, we're lawmakers. Our job is to create a law that, well, if you believe in certain values that underpin that, which are underpinned by those cultural values that those people believe who vote for us, is for a society to explore the opportunity for everybody to be able to live out the fullness of their life without harming others. But just take this conversation, this is what this whole conversation is about. People have defined what Israel Folau is as hate speech, whereas other people have said, no, like me, it should be, you know, even though I disagree with it, it should be permitted within society because it doesn't meet the test of harassment. And where people see the line of harm, as the gentleman raised before, is part of the constant discussion we need to have. That's democracy.
I think that we want... one of the reasons why I find the Israel Folau case, what he wrote, was terrible, because I actually don't think that represents really what Christianity is. I think, you know, there's compassion, and I think there's a lack thereof, even if you take it, you know, as, well, he's sort of saying he's trying to tough love sort of thing. Abstract love. That's, and then he's trying to kind of... That's exactly right. No, I agree with you. It's not. And that's why I think there's real problems with what he said. But I think in terms of humanism and where we are as people, we are all informed, I think, by principles around how, you know, how we would treat each other and how we like to live, which is really what you were saying about... you know, how people live out their lives. And whether you believe in, you know, utilitarianism or however that might manifest itself, I think, you know, I think we strive every day to be good human beings. I think most people do that. And maybe that makes me a terrible optimist. But but I do think that, and I think that's how society functions.
Kimberly, many thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.